Thanks for tuning in to the Eastern Current Saltwater Fishing Podcast presented by Florida Fishing Products. I've been fishing the Florida reels for a few seasons now, and I've been nothing but impressed. The quality and durability of the reels are second to none. The Solas, Bahia, and Osprey CE Pro cover all the bases for your inshore light tackle setups, whether you're a weekend warrior or a year-round guy. If you like pulling on big fish, they've got you covered as well with the Resolute Series reels. Go check out the reels online at floridafishingproducts.com or click the link in the podcast show notes. On today's episode, I have the privilege of sitting down with Captain Wayne of Tidewater on the Fly. We've had Wayne on before, and he's always a crowd favorite. On today's episode, we talk about a healthy life on the water. That's whether you're a fishing guide or just a recreational angler. Hope y'all enjoy. If you're like us here at Eastern Current, your boat trailer takes a beating. That's why we want to tell you about Coastal Trailer Repair, located here in Wilmington, North Carolina. At Coastal Trailer Repair, they strive to bring quality work at a reasonable price, specializing in trailer hubs, springs, and all things electrical and wiring. If you have an issue with your trailer, look no further than Coastal Trailer Repair to get you back on the road. You can find their information in the podcast show notes. What's going on, Wayne? Thanks for hopping on another podcast. It's been a while since we've chatted. It's been a long, it seems like we chat in the wintertime. So we both get busy in the summer, but thanks for doing another podcast with us.
Oh, absolutely, Judd. I always look forward to it and enjoy listening to your podcast. And I think you guys are doing great work. And hopefully we can go down some paths tonight that haven't gone down before, you know?
Yeah, I'm excited about that. When Wayne and I were kind of texting about this maybe last week or a week before, he threw an idea out, which I really liked. And we were just chatting before. I was like, what should we call this? But I think overall, we're going to really chat about how to live a healthy life on the water. One, how it's healthy to be out there fishing and spending time in the outdoors. But two, like how to do it safely and be healthy and make the right decisions while you're out there and before you get out there. So excited to talk with you about that. I think Wayne's going to be able to carry this whole conversation because he's super knowledgeable in it. But why don't you kind of give your backstory of your profession now, what you did before, and kind of how that led to this conversation topic?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Judd. I'm actually a physical therapist by trade. So I think we talked about this on the first podcast. Yeah. I was a Delaware kid, came down here to play football at William & Mary, and got introduced to a physical therapist when I was at William & Mary as an athlete, and then I went down to Duke for my master's program in physical therapy, came back and found a home here on the lower part of the Chesapeake Bay. So I live in Newport News, Virginia, and fish most of our waters down here, including the lower part of the Chesapeake Bay and then the James River system, and which includes the Elizabeth River system. And then I'm up in the Nansman River. I may go all the way up to Kings Mill and the James. I may go up, you know, around the Mobjack Bay area, but Chris Newsom, Captain Chris Newsom is up that way. So I definitely, Chris has helped me out tremendously through the years and respect. He does a great job on his waters up there. So I'm kind of from the York River down, but I decided to get my doctorate back in 16, which it took me about 4 years. So I finally got my doctorate in 19. And there were two areas that I really spent a lot of time studying in addition to some of the musculoskeletal issues that are typical in physical therapy. And one of them was vestibular rehab. So there's a subspecialty in PT that addresses vestibular problems. And it made me aware that, you know, motion sickness, seasickness that we see frequently with people who are not used to being on the water can be dealt with. And then the second issue was hydration, and started to do a lot of research on hydration and really adopted some best practices there and have been able to help people tremendously with, you know, evening leg cramps, for instance, is classic with the fishing industry. And then, you know, just the whole issue of how do we stay healthy as fishermen? It tends to be, as far as your lower extremity goes, you know, you got to deal with balance, but you aren't necessarily exercising like you would if you were riding a bike or walking.
Right.
You know, so it's a little different situation. You know, you're on a, I mean, you and I are typically on boats, you know, we're not, if you were walking a stream out in Colorado, it'd be a completely different metabolic day than what we have on the boat. But the boat actually does provide a challenge, and you're burning about 200 calories an hour, you know, if you're actively fishing, which, you know, if you think about a lot of what we do, it's not just sitting there. You're active.
Oh, for
all
sure.
Day long. Yeah.
Especially so, polling.
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, the guide is working his butt off, but so is the angler. You
right,
know? And,
right.
And so just the whole issue of balancing on a boat brings a different dynamic than what people are typically used to. And being outdoors, the studies would indicate that being outdoors, whether you're a hunter, whether you're a hiker, or whether you're a fisherman, is really good for you. And I think it's the, you know, the whole concept of how tired you get when you're outdoors all day in that fresh air. You got vitamin D coming from the sun, which you do need to protect your skin. I know we're going to talk about that. But there's something special about being outdoors that's good for you, good for the soul, and it lowers your stress level. People tend to have less depression who are outdoor-type folks. The overall health profile is actually really good. So as long as you're doing the right things, fishermen and hunters and hikers and skiers and everybody that's outdoors, it's just a wonderful way to spend your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
we're lucky.
Yeah, we're super lucky. So tell me, before we chatted, we kind of talked through a few of the important things that you felt that we needed to know as anglers, as far as our health goes. Let's kind of hit some of those pinpoints and talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jug. You know, there's a few things, Jug, that with regards to just general health that we probably can kind of cruise by quickly. But like, obviously with being outdoors, there are risks involved. So sort of the big ticket items that you and I were talking about before is, you know, preventing death, like a catastrophic event.
Right.
And, you know, when you're a captain, you actually think about those things a lot because, you know, liability is really your first concern, is you want to keep people safe. And so, you know, the two things, obviously being a responsible boat captain, whether you're a recreational angler or whether you're a professional boat captain, you know, that's a serious job. So, you know, taking the safety piece serious, and making sure that, you know, when you're operating the boat, you're not drinking and driving. I think that's a critical piece. And then the second thing is preventing falls.
Yeah.
And so I run two different boats. I run a 32-foot Boston Whaler with a big tower, and we're out in the Chesapeake Bay in the summertime. And we do allow clients to go up in the tower. But my mate, Baylor, who's terrific, either Baylor and I, when a client is going up or down that vertical ladder, we're always below them first. So if they're coming down, we go down first. If they're going up, then we, you know, we're let them go up first. Yeah. Because I'm always worried about a fall. You know, if you had a fall off a vertical ladder like that out in the bay
with the boat rocking, you know, and everything.
Yeah, exactly. You could have a really bad injury. So, Knock on wood, we haven't had that yet, but we're certainly, you know, we're on our game, man. When they're moving around, we're on top of them. And then on polling skiffs, you know, I actually had an angler fall last week off the casting deck. It was my first fall, man, in my 4 years. Yeah. And she didn't get hurt, but certainly could have been a bad incident. So, you know, just again, managing moving around a small boat and providing hand grabs, and making sure that you communicate before moving around. You know, just having that part of your game together is really important. And from a health initiative, you know, again, we don't need to beat these topics up necessarily, but I do think, you know, preventing those catastrophic events that where you really ruin somebody's day is real important. And then some of the other ones, Judd, is like, you and I were talking beforehand, you know, we've lost between Virginia and North Carolina over the last few years, we've lost 7 people due to bacteria infections from primarily stagnant salt water. And it usually comes from an open lesion, or it comes from eating raw seafood. But in this case, all 5 of these deaths came from recreational boating or angling in our 2 states. And so, you know, avoiding infections is really important. And, you know, when you're cleaning fish at the end of the day, and when you're taking hooks out of fish, you know, particularly treble hooks, I've had a couple of people get impaled on my boat recreationally, and I have not had anybody get impaled while I've been a captain. But it's certainly, you know, you got to be careful there. So I think preventing, you know, punctures and lacerations and impalements from hooks is really important. So, you know, using caution and using gloves and using pliers and dehookers, making sure that you're, you know, you really are on your game there. Those things are really important. You know, you don't have a catastrophic issue very often, but when you do, obviously the impact is terrible. So
for sure.
Yeah.
One thing that, that 2 little quick stories that have to go along with that, that I've encountered. One, first with being impaled by the hook, obviously, you know, as a fishing guide, you're going to see that with time on the water. It's just going to happen sometimes. But, one thing I learned, used to, people would want, or people still often want, you know, they catch a nice redfish on topwater. So I had a client catch a really nice, like 31-inch redfish on a topwater plug, wanted the topwater in its mouth for the picture. And he's sitting on the casting platform holding the redfish with the topwater hanging out of its mouth. And the redfish flopped. He let go of it. One of the trebles buried into his knee, and it was still attached to that fish. And so that was the last time I ever let anybody hold a fish. But we, you know, we had to get dikes and cut the hooks off to get the fish off. Keeping dikes on your boat for hooks is very important. Pliers are helpful, but sometimes you need to cut that hook. We had a client one time get a hook buried inside of their ear in a back cast from another client with a treble hook. So we had to cut that one out with dikes. So just being really careful with those hooks. If it's a single J hook or something like that, or a fly, it's really not that big of a deal to keep it in the fish's mouth. But if you've got trebles, you should take it out of the fish's mouth, because nothing's worse than that fish hanging, flopping from hooked into you and flopping around still attached to the lure. It's hard to handle. The other story that I wanted to share about that bacteria, we were at a sandbar. This was back in, before I was married, but I was with my cousins and some friends, and there was a piece of glass, a broken glass bottle that was apparently in the sand, and we were in about waist deep water, and my cousin stepped on it, cut his foot, and just, you know, a normal cut hurts bad, but like about 10 o'clock that night, it was throbbing, it looked gnarly, and he went to the ER, and that bacteria had like set in his foot. Ooh. And he was able to get a shot, but it was the kind of thing that could have killed him, or he could have had to get his leg amputated like that quick, within a few hours. So it's definitely not something to take lightly if you do have a cut or something like that. So is there anything, if you do get a serious cut or puncture, like what's the next step, would you say?
Well, first of all, what you just said is exactly right, Judd. So the gentleman that unfortunately passed in my marina in Hampton, Virginia, 2 seasons ago, we lost a man to Vibrio, which is, a bacteria that grows in primarily stagnant salt water. You know, you never think of your marina as like your most dangerous waters, but right. In a lot of ways they are, because you got boats, a lot of boats that are in a marina. So if somebody makes a mistake, something bad could happen. Then you also have water that doesn't typically move through marinas as much as it does out, you know, once you're outside the marinas. So the most important thing is exactly what you just said, Joe, which is do not take these things lightly. The proper procedure is to clean the wound immediately, and then observe the wound. There's no treatment that necessarily needs to occur afterwards. But as soon as you see any signs that the wound is infected, then you need to go to the emergency room or to a dock in the box type of place and immediately start having it treated medically. And then it may not put you on an antibiotic immediately, but if you've got proper medical supervision, then they'll put you on an antibiotic fairly quickly.
Okay.
And what happened in this guy's case, Joe, was he didn't take it seriously. So what happened was he got impaled in his leg, and he was messing with eels. And it started out as an infection of the leg, and he sort of shoulder shrugged it, and it went on for weeks. And then when it got really bad, they ended up taking his leg, but it had spread systemically, and they couldn't get it under control, and he ended up passing away.
Golly.
So, yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you're gonna watch it out, and you're going to cover it. And then, again, just keep it covered and then keep it clean the next couple of days. If you see it look like it's getting red, swollen, if there's any kind of, you know, pus or altered color, then you ought to go get medical help at that point. So, yeah, it's something that people need to take seriously, and you're better safe than sorry, you know?
Absolutely. No, you don't need to try to be the tough guy and shoulder shrug something like that. Not that people are necessarily being that, but I feel like that's the stance that guys take a lot of times. Like, oh, it's just a little wound. It's going to be fine. I'll be fine. But it can.
Well, and you know, tetanus is a bad thing too, and you need to get a tetanus injection if you've been impaled by a hook. And you know, the last time I saw that happen was we had a great big striper. It was like a 50-pound striper, and it was like a stretch 25. And one of my buddies was putting his hand down there to get the stretch 25 out, and I said something to him right before that fish flopped. I said, you know, don't use your hand. Use the pliers. And the fish flopped one time, and then he's got an 8-aught treble hook, you know, all the way down into his thumb. So it's just not wise to put your hand or anything else close to treble hooks or single hooks. Just not good procedure. So yeah, that has to be taken very seriously. No question.
For sure. So what were some of the next points that we had discussed before we hopped on here?
Well, we talked, Judd, about those three are kind of your traumatic three. So those are the ones that can end in terrible things and terrible things in short order. So you got to take those seriously. Yeah. The other ones I think people might find more interesting, which is, you know, what do you do throughout the day to deal with things that occur, you know, whether it's pain or cramps or that sort of thing. And so I'll kind of go through these on what I think are priorities. And the first one is the whole concept of hydration. So I find a lot of anglers, Judd, who are not used to being on their feet all day, you know, they book you for a trip or they have a desk job all week long and they're sitting all day long and they're in an air conditioned environment. And then they go out and they fish on a Saturday recreationally, or they're on your boat and now they're on their feet all day long and they're okay during the day. But in the evening, they end up with severe leg cramps. And that's a common thing to occur with people who are out in the sun and on their feet all day. And so I'll kind of paint the picture of what occurs in these cases. So the first thing is that we're all kind of used to the culture that we live in. We get up in the morning and we drink coffee. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we start drinking beer,
right,
or our alcohol of especially when you're fishing. And so you start your day out with a diuretic, and you finish your day up with a diuretic. And that's a bad equation, because what happens with diuretics is you're peeing out that water. So if you look at what happens when you hydrate, so you always have to replace your water. And if you're in the sun all day, then particularly in the summertime, you're burning up, you know, a lot more water, quite frankly. Your body is throwing off water to reduce heat. And so if you look at an athlete and they're sweating, you know, they're getting ready. They're getting rid of heat by sweating. And in that sweat is also sodium and potassium primarily, but there's also other electrolytes, but primarily you're looking at water, sodium, and potassium. And if you start out your day with a diuretic, which I do, I'm always, you get a cup of coffee in the morning?
I drink another caffeine drink, but I like coffee, but I like to sit down and drink my coffee slow. So it's usually not how my morning's going when I'm guiding.
Yeah, there you go. And my wife drinks tea, you know, but tea's a diuretic too. These are all caffeinated drinks. So you're starting your day off with caffeine and you're finishing your day off with alcohol, a lot of people. So, you know, those are two drinks that are going to end up dehydrating you. So you add to that, when you're standing, you know, you're in what we typically call a dependent position. So your heart is in your chest and it's almost like a well of water, you know, and all that water is going to pull to your feet. So a lot of people will have swelling in their feet and their ankles. And if you're peeing throughout the day, you're essentially getting rid of the water that you're taking in. So a lot of people hydrate all day long. They'll be drinking water all day long, but they won't take in any salt. And so you can hydrate during the day, but your body is getting rid of that water either through sweat or through pee. And so the water is not actually being used to hydrate your tissues. And so what has to happen to allow your body to use that tissue is you have to have the right salt and water balance. And it's fundamental science. It's osmosis. So if you don't have enough salt, then the body's going to try and equalize its pH level. And so you're going to pee more. So you can drink more and more water, but you don't retain that water. And so a lot of the science that's been looked at over the last 10 years is really looking at a balance between intake of water and salt. And I'm a big believer in that model. So one of the problem with drinking a salted water is that it's awful. It's like just, you can't even tolerate it. You know, it's just not palatable at all. So the typical equation is you're going to use twice as much sweetener as you use salt. So for instance, this is what I tend to do when I hydrate is I will take a big glass of water and I'll use a quarter to a half a teaspoon of salt, which will give you roughly 400 to 1,000 milligrams of sodium.
Okay.
And then twice as much sugar. And in my case, I use maple syrup. And the reason I use maple syrup is you really want to stay away from fructose, which is sort of like your Gatorade drinks.
Right, right.
And so maple syrup is primarily sucrose, and so a little bit easier to digest, number one. And there's some secondary issues with some of the other sugars that sucrose and glucose don't have. But you could use stevia if you don't want any sugar intake at all. But you want to use about twice as much sugar as you use salt. And so you're drinking a salted drink, and you'll taste it. It will be salted. But that way, your body is actually taking the water and using it as opposed to dumping it out to equalize the pH level. So,
gotcha.
I think you and I were talking before, there, not to give any particular electrolyte company any prompts here, but I think Element, LMNT, that those folks have done a really good job of looking at the research and then coming up with a product that is evidence-based and makes sense.
Yeah.
It's also expensive. So, you know, you can do your own like I do, you know, again, a quarter to a half teaspoon of salt and then twice as much maple syrup, mix it up in a big glass of water. And I find that prevents nighttime leg cramps, which I have a lot of folks that talk to me about that. If you have low blood pressure, tend to have low blood pressure, which, again, if you think about blood pressure, it's how much fluid is in your system. You know, people that have high blood pressure tend to have essentially more fluid in their arteries and veins and tissues. That's why the pressure is high.
Yeah.
Someone that has low blood pressure will have lower overall water levels, so that they'll be more prone to cramps. So you'll see more nighttime leg cramps with people who have low blood pressure than you will with people who have high blood pressure. So these electrolyte drinks can be really helpful. Avoiding diuretics, so quite frankly, not taking caffeine in the morning, not taking alcohol in the afternoon is also helpful. But, you know, a lot of us like those kinds of drinks. And so what you're trying to do is provide the hydration that your body needs. And if you're going to use those diuretics, then you need to supplement those drinks with drinks that your body is going to retain.
Yeah.
And that's where a salted drink does help. The body's dumping water if you have diuretics like alcohol and caffeine. So you need to offset that with drinks that the body's going to retain. And that's going to require adding salt to the product. If you look at Gatorade, it doesn't really have a ton of salt. Nothing like Element has. Some of the other electrolytes don't have as much salt as Element, but still are significant sources of salt. So a lot of the electrolyte type products are significantly better than just drinking water on it, you know, in and of itself. But a lot of them that are really high sugar content, particularly fructose, like a Gatorade product, you know, not necessarily your best option.
Yeah, that's good to know, because I feel like it's so easy to just go into the gas station and grab a, you know, obviously I keep waters on the boat all the time, but grab a Gatorade or something like that, throw it in there and feel like,
you know, like
doing myself a favor, but I'm probably not.
Not necessarily. I mean, Pedialyte or Gatorade is the better product. I mean, Gatorade actually makes a light product that I think is better than their standard Gatorade.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, adding salt even to that, like literally opening up the top of your Gatorade and putting about a quarter to a half of a teaspoon of salt in the Gatorade before you go out of the, you know, out of your convenience store is not a bad idea, provided your blood pressure is not high. Now, if your blood pressure is high, you need to be careful.
Yeah.
Because the whole purpose of this hydration is to retain, is to have more fluids available for your tissues to use. So again, if you're hydrating, but you're just dumping the water through sweat or pee, then you're really not helping your body.
Right.
There's a balance here. And certainly the combination of salt and water seems to be, you know, that's the ticket. It's just an issue of what does that look like for you personally?
Right.
So someone that has higher blood pressure, less salt, more water. Someone that has low blood pressure would go with a higher salt content. And okay. Even, you know, shouldn't really be scared of even, you know, if you look at some of the U.S. DA recommendations, it's like, I think they can go much higher than that. You know, it's, if you've got low blood pressure, I don't think you have to be worried about having fairly highly salted drinks. And if you go on the Element, their website, they put out pretty good, research, on what they've done with their electrolyte products. I think they're well thought out and, purposeful and, make a lot of sense in my mind.
For sure. Well, I think one of the other things we talked about that is something that happens to me a lot with clients, if I'm fishing the ocean, I imagine it happens to you a lot in the bay, fishing bigger water, is motion sickness. And, you know, how people can prepare before they get in the water and then deal with it afterwards. I'm curious to kind of hear your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've done extensive research in this area, and essentially motion sickness occurs when your brain is taking in data and it can't modulate that data. And that's why, you know, you hear about sailors getting their sea legs. And my daughter married a young man from Idaho this past November, wonderful young man, and Logan's from Idaho, and he's a sailor, so he's in the U.S. Navy here. You know, just got out of the U.S. Navy actually after being in for 6 years. But when Julia met Logan, he was a sailor, and you know, when you get on a ship and you haven't been out to sea, you know, you hear about sailors needing to get their sea legs, and that is actually a true phenomenon. So, you know, the first prevention is what in medicine is what's called habituation, which is, you know, you make it a habit. So before you go on a fishing trip, if you tend to get seasick, if every day you rolled, so literally lay down on the ground in your bedroom and roll around on the floor,
that's
and
awesome.
your significant other is looking at you going, "What in the hell are you doing?" or you go from laying on your side to laying on your back to sitting up to standing to laying back down and rolling across your bed and doing the same thing on the opposite side, and you did that for 5 minutes every day for 2 weeks before your fishing trip, you would probably be significantly better when you went out to sea. And so some other things that you want to do about essentially you're really managing how your brain takes this data in. So the more abnormal data the brain is taking in, so stuff that they're not used to, the more likely you are to get seasick. So you always hear people talk about diesel engine yep. fumes. And that's a tough one, because if you're on a diesel boat, then, you know, and you've not been used to being around diesel equipment, then that may be a trigger. And literally, if you knew you were going to be fishing and you knew that there was a bunch of school buses down the street and they were diesel school buses and they were leaving every day at 8 o'clock, and you went down there every day for 2 weeks. And smell the diesel fuel and did some activity, some exercise while you kind of hung around those diesel trucks, that would help tremendously. It would get you used to that smell before you got on the trip. It really makes a difference. So the first thing you want to do is before you do your trip is to see if you can acclimatize to some of the factors that you're going to have to do on your trip. And the balance and moving around, and then, you know, smells, that's one. Once you're on the boat, the issue of the visual information that your body gets, you know, you hear of people that go inside the cabin on a cabin boat, and then they get seasick, and that's true. So as long as they stay in the cockpit and they have a view of the horizontal plane, then they're fine, because their brain is able to see the horizontal plane, and that information makes sense to them. It's consistent with what they have on a day-to-day basis just moving around on land.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a true phenomenon. So staying visually connected to the horizon is helpful. And then small amounts of food, and actually small amounts of alcohol. So, you know, when someone drinks a ton of alcohol, their vestibular system shuts down, so they lose their balance, and that's why they stumble around and slur their words, and, you know, you see very uncoordinated movements in a person that's drunk. But small amounts of alcohol actually do shut down your vestibular system. So there's a balance between hydrating throughout a fishing day, but small amounts of foods that are not high acid foods, so breads and crackers, and then, believe it or not, small amounts of beer, even early in the morning, can help people with seasickness. But they have to be careful how much they take. Obviously, you don't want to get drunk on a boat. It's never a good idea, ever, ever, ever. But small amounts of food and small amounts of alcohol, statistically, or the evidence is that it does reduce people's seasickness. And then medicine, you know, we talked a little bit beforehand, Judd, you know, there's no question that medicines are effective. So The amazing thing about Dramamine, which is the medicine of choice as an antihistamine for people who get seasick, is a couple things on Dramamine. First of all, you want to, if you are going to take Dramamine, you're better off starting it the night before. So if you're going to fish on a, say, a Saturday morning, then you want to make sure you get good hydration the night before. Don't drink a lot of alcohol the night before. Get a good night's sleep. And then start your Dramamine the night before, because it'll make you sleepy anyway. So it'll help you sleep, and it'll get your vestibular system sort of shut down a little bit. You know, what an antihistamine does is it blocks receptors in your brains, to prevent motion sickness. And so you can use any antihistamine. Dramamine is the medicine of choice, but if you don't have Dramamine, you could use Claritin or Benadryl or Allegra. Those medicines will help. And then you can use any of the anti-muscarines, which are like scopolamine is the one that you hear all the time.
Okay.
And they basically block your brain's the effect of acetylcholine, which, you know, is just a, chemical in your brain, and it kind of shuts that down in your central nervous system. And if anybody's used the scopolamine patch, they'll tell you it works tremendously, and it really does. So I encourage people to see their doctor, and providing there's no contraindications, to use medicines to treat motion sickness. But before you go on your trip, you ought to do some of these things to help reduce the risk of getting motion sickness. I know one thing, and I'm sure you feel the same way. If someone gets motion sick on your boat, it's almost, the day is over.
Oh yeah.
They don't recover very often.
No, they don't. They really don't. It's tough. And you get some people that want to fight it and don't want to go in. You get some people that they're immediately like, all right, this is, I'm over it. It's not worth it. It'll shut a man down pretty quick.
Yeah, I agree. Occasionally you see somebody that's super tough and just has the ability to just power through it. But
that guy's not me.
That's the minority. Usually once you get sick, it's over. It's a tough day.
So tell me about this, and we'll kind of wrap up here as we're approaching 45 minutes. But have you had any experience with, I know they've got, you know, the pressure points and the patch behind the ear, but I've had some clients recently that bring these like electric stimulation watches that kind of shock your wrist. What's your take on that?
They work.
That's what I've seen.
The evidence is clear. They work. So what they do, Judd, is they provide your brain with an alternative set of data points. So, you know, if you look at why is the brain has this, it's trying to modulate all this information that comes in. It's some of it's visual, some of it's auditory, could be smell. And then the proprioceptive piece is the big one. So your vestibular system is being, it's just being bombarded with the boat moving around. It's interesting, Judd, because I do a lot of inshore fishing this time of year, and I'll be on almost slick, calm water. Like, you can't imagine that somebody could get a little seasick, and I will have people that still will get a little queasy, and they'll tell me as soon as I get on the boat and the floor is no longer a fixed floor like it is in the rest of my life, and it just moves around a little bit, I have a problem. And I have seen that. So what the wristbands do is they provide your brain with an alternative sensory input that the brain attends to. And so it no longer attends to some of the other data that's coming in that's overloaded.
Okay.
You know, like all the movement. Yeah, it actually is very effective. It creates a distraction for your brain. It's the same phenomena as to why a lot of people have nighttime pain.
Okay.
And the reason that you have nighttime pain isn't because mechanically that your body part is under more stress at night. It can be accumulative from all day long, but it's more really that your brain is shutting down, paying attention to all the rest of what's going on in life. So when you don't have a bunch of other input coming into your brain, whether it's your kids, you know, they're running around and you're having to deal with the kids, or you're having a conversation with your wife, or you're watching TV, your brain can only take in so much. So you don't feel the pain, you know, until you go to bed. And then when you go to bed and try and shut your brain down, now all of a sudden, you know, your knee is aching that wasn't hurting you all day long.
So that wristwatch
will actually, I mean, that electric trigger on that wristband will actually provide enough stimulation to your brain that it doesn't pay attention to other data.
So it's essentially just distracting your brain from focusing on something else.
Yeah. But it works. That's cool. Yeah. They're very effective. There's no question about it.
Well, before we wrap up here, kind of tell me what you're doing fishing wise right now, and what's your upcoming season?
I just am on the tail end of my winter speckled trout season, and we've had a really good season this year because the winter's been mild, and we've had really good shallow water speckled trout fishing this winter down in the lower part of Virginia. And I've been mostly in the Elizabeth River system, but it's been really fun. And we've got bull red drum that are moving in, should be moving in about 2 weeks. And our speckled trout are going to start to move out of the system and push north and head down to Carolina too. They kind of come out and start and split. But a lot of those fish are going to start to move up in the bay, and they'll end up at, you know, Tangier Sound and Chrisfield, Maryland, by June. And but we'll have some big post-spawn stripers in the system in late April. Our bull drum arrive in late March, so a little bit, the drum come before the stripers. And then my cobia will arrive like mid-May, and we'll be into them by June 1st. And then I'll stay on the cobia all summer long. And then once the cobia leave our system, which is sort of about the second week in September, usually. I mean, we got some fish that'll linger all the way through into October. But I usually shut my cobia trips down about mid-September. Then I'll move inshore again, and I'll be on all three of the species here, stripers, reds, speckled trout, until the winter speckled trout season kind of settles in late December. So that's kind of my year.
That's awesome. Sounds like fun times ahead for sure. Yeah. If people want to get up with you, reach out and chat about maybe some of the health stuff we've talked about today, or book a trip and get out in the water with you, what's the best way for them to find you?
Well, one, the thing that we did talk about, Judd, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They could call me anytime they want, is kind of some of the musculoskeletal things, like total knee replacement. How do you cast with a shoulder problem, and what do I do about my back pain when I'm standing all day long on a boat and I can't seem to handle it? Those are the things that are sort of bread and butter physical therapy. And I'm happy to talk to people about what you can do to modify, you know, whether it's what you're doing on a regular basis, or how you modify your day to try and get through the day better, or should I be resting, you know, this problem, or should I be exercising these problems, and those sorts of things. I am more than happy to help anybody with that. I get a lot of questions when I do lectures about that sort of thing. And the best way to reach me is either email me at Wayne@tidewateronthefly.com, or text me on my cell phone, which is 757-775-7034.
Awesome.
And the other area, Judd, are the night cramp.
Oh, yeah.
If people are having post-fishing, like, leg cramps, or their hands are cramping, that's a hydration issue, and I can help them with that. That's something that they ought to reach out to me, because I've done a lot of research in that area and feel like I can really help them with how to manage that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something that, you know, people just kind of don't pay attention to. They get out and fish, but these ways that we can, these things we can apply to make our, you know, our time on the water and when we get off the water more enjoyable, are huge. Especially as I get older, I'm starting to feel a lot of this stuff we're talking about. And I know, you know, as we all get older, and so these things are, they might not be an issue for a young angler now, but as they get older, they're definitely going to feel these effects as well as I have. But yeah, man, I think that was a super interesting podcast, and I'm sitting here, I jotted down a few notes on my phone actually, especially the hydration concoction that you were talking about, so I can give that a shot. Especially in the heat of the summer, man, it just gets so hot, and I think I just drink too much Gatorade and not enough salt. But I'm excited to give that a shot. But man, thank you so much for jumping on and doing a podcast. We'll have to get you back on. I'd love to chat with you in the heat of your summer fishing, which we haven't done before. So we'll have to set something up for that.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Judd. You guys do a great job, and it's been a great podcast for me to listen to, and I've learned a lot from everyone you've interviewed and you. So thank you very much for all of that.
Yeah, for sure, man. I've learned so much just chatting with you. I feel like every time I do chat with you, I need to have a notebook out, whether it's about fly fishing or, you know, health or any of this stuff.
Either that or a 12-pack, and you just got to hit it really hard.
Right,
you know?
Right, exactly.
One or the other.
Exactly. Well, man, well, thank you so much, guys. Thanks for checking out.
All right, man.
Thanks for checking out another Eastern Current episode, and we will see y'all next week. Later.
Take care of them kids, man.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it this evening.
All right, brother.
All right, later, man.
See you, Jeff.
Bye.
Yep, thanks.